Good morning, members. Good morning, members. I'm going to call the tax committee to order. And members, here's what we're going to do. We're going to break for 20 minutes, and we're going to come back, and then the bill will be available in 20 minutes in the back of the room. So we are going to recess right now, and Representative Simpson is in room 500 North. And the Republicans and DSL will be in 500 South. We'll be back in 20 minutes, and we're going to listen through the wall to what each other says. So we are in recess for 20 minutes. Okay, everyone, thank you for your patience. We're back from recess. So thank you for your patience. And we're back from recess, and we are going to start the walkthrough of the 2008 Omnibus Tax Bill. And members should have everything they need in their packets. We had a lot of extra copies of everything in the back, and we now understand almost all of it's gone. And we've requested that duplicating, which is just on the other side of the hall, print more of everything. So they'll be doing that, and we'll bring them to the back of the room as soon as we have it. So with that, members, thank you for your patience and allowing all of us to have caucus meetings on the bill briefly. Today we're going to just do the walkthrough. Tomorrow morning we'll start with public testimony at 9 a.m. and then we'll mark it up tomorrow as well. So with that, we're just going to have the staff walk through the bill. I did want to just make a couple preliminary comments about really what the omnibus tax bill is this year that we're proposing, and it's really three things. It is a recommitment to our property tax relief proposal last year, which is a progressive property tax restructuring based on the ability to pay. We remain committed to that concept. We are now trying to achieve the same goal of progressive property tax relief within the confines of the governor's wishes to not raise taxes. So that's the change. We're not infusing a big income tax increase to pay for it. We are instead making choices in a tough situation to provide significant property tax relief to those who have high property tax burdens relative to their income tax. So if you are paying more than 2% of your income in property taxes and you earn under $200,000 a year, we are attempting to provide relief without a tax increase. Additionally, we are keeping our commitment to our state and local fiscal relations through aids and credits, through the local government aid system, the county aid system, and township aid. And so we'll be walking through that in the bill. And then thirdly, we're trying to make choices in a difficult time with the deficit, and we are cutting some of the corporate subsidies that exist in the Minnesota tax code. So those are kind of the big pieces. Progressive property tax relief for those who are least able to pay. Continue to have our state local fiscal relationship with our local units of government, and then cut some corporate subsidies. So with that, if we can just start with the staff and members, we'll just take questions as we go. And so we start with Article 1. And Ms. Manzi is going to walk us through that. And Ms. Manzi, also I should tell you, when we're through with her explaining Article 1, I think at that point she will show us a property tax calculator that allow all of us to see what this proposal does, and it will be posted on the tax committee website, and I'm not sure if it'll be on where else it'll be, but the public will be able to go online, and all of you in the room, and enter your income and your property taxes and your home value and see how you do under this proposal. So we're very confident that folks will like it, since about 95% of Minnesotans will do the same or better. And so Ms. Manzi will walk us through how we can all later take a look at how it affects us individually. So with that, Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from House Research. Article 1 is the Homestead Credit State Refund. It replaces the current law property tax relief programs that are directed to individuals, with the exception of the targeted property tax refund and the renter's property tax refund. It takes the other three and replaces them with a new homestead credit state refund. The three programs that are eliminated over time are the market value homestead credit, which is based on the home value, the property tax refund, which is based on an individual's property taxes relative to their income, and the state income tax deduction for property taxes, the value of which increases as an individual's income and state marginal tax rate increases. I think I'm not going to really go through it section by section, but rather talk about the three things that are eliminated and then the new program. The rest of the sections in the article are sort of coordinating and technical sections to make it all work. The first piece that you see in the summary that is eliminated is the current law market value homestead credit. This is calculated based on the value of the home, and it will be phased out over a five-year period. In 2009, the credit will be allowed at 100%, and then it decreases each year following until 2014, when no credit will be allowed. The second piece that you see in the summary shows up in Section 3, and this is the addition to taxable income for real and personal property taxes that are deducted on the federal level. This does not have an effect on the amount of property taxes that are allowed to be deducted at the federal level, but it simply disallows that deduction at the state level. Under current law, individuals are required to add back the state taxable income, the state income tax deduction that's allowed at the federal level. This will add to that the property tax deduction that's allowed at the federal level. So right now you are already going through a calculation to add back your income taxes to the extent that your total itemized deductions exceed your standard deduction, and there will be added to that an add back for the property taxes. It's going to continue to preserve the standard deduction amount for all filers. So if a person is not very far into being an itemizer, they will not have to add back so much as to push them below the standard deduction amount. So the add back is limited by the difference between their total itemized deductions and their federal standard deductions.
Madam Chair. Do you want to wait until
I'm
happy to wait until we go through the entire article and then come back.
The best way to understand this is have staff explain the whole thing and show examples, because it is complicated. And we went through this in division, by the way, members. Fairness is very complicated. Simplicity is generally very unfair. So it is complicated because we're trying to make as fair of a property tax system based on ability to pay as possible. So I think that we found in trying to explain this to folks that the best way is to kind of hear the whole thing, see the whole thing work, and then take questions. So that's my preference for Representative Coles.
That's fine, Michelle. I'll read to the end of the article. Hold
okay. Thanks, Ms. Nancy.
It should continue. The current law homeowner property tax refund, which is sometimes referred to as the circuit breaker, is being replaced by a new homestead credit state refund, which is somewhat similar in structure. The current law property tax refund has threshold percentages that increase as a person's income increases. And if they have property taxes that exceed that threshold for their income level, then they're eligible for a property tax refund. The new program establishes a flat 2% threshold percentage for all incomes up to the maximum income eligible. So it's a little bit simpler than the current law program, in which the percentages range from 1% up to 4%. The 1% and lower percentages apply at very low incomes, and people would have to have really extremely high property taxes relative to income of something less than $10,000 a year in order to have a lower amount qualify for refund under the new program than under the current program. We tried to calculate some examples that looked like they might really exist, in which a person got a lower refund under the new program than under the current program, and we didn't have much success coming up with any. So even though that threshold percentage increases for very low income people, because the refund percentage is also going to increase for that group, people end up getting the same or greater refund in that range. The next step of the refund program, which is also similar to the current property tax refund program, that you take the amount over the 2% of your income and you multiply it by a refund percentage. And that refund percentage decreases from 90% for very low income homeowners to 25% for homeowners with incomes from about $115,000 up to the $200,000 maximum income. So you would get a percentage of your property taxes that are over 2% of your income refunded to you, and then the final step is up to a maximum amount. The maximum amount under the proposed program is $2,500. That's greater than the maximum under the current law property tax refund, which for payable 09 would be $1,810. Those maximums will be indexed for inflation, as are the maximums under the current law property tax refund. Another difference between the new refund and the current refund is that the new refund is calculated on a larger tax measure than is the current refund. The current refund is calculated based on property taxes after the market value homestead credit has been deducted. So it's after that comes off, which makes it a smaller property tax amount. The new refund would be calculated on property taxes before deduction of the market value homestead credit. So most people will be going into the new schedule with a larger tax amount to look up than they are on the current schedule. Now at the end of calculating the new refund, when you get to how much you qualify for, at that point, whatever amount of market value homestead credit is allowed for that year is subtracted from your new homestead credit state refund so that you aren't in effect getting that twice. One effect of this is that as the current market value homestead credit is phased out over time, the homestead credit state refund will increase because there will be a smaller amount of market value homestead credit to subtract at the end of the calculation. That will be the case for people who are on the new refund schedule and who are not at the maximum amount as yet. People who have higher incomes, they will simply be losing the market value homestead credit, and people who are up against the maximum refund on the new schedule will not get the full benefit of the credit added back into it. The refund schedule extends to a much higher income than the current law refund schedule. It extends to $200,000 compared to about $96,000 under the current schedule. And the income ranges for the schedule will be indexed each year for inflation, as are the income ranges for the current refund schedule. I think that is the explanation of the article and the new credit. Would you like me to move on to the examples?
Just the mark. Thank you. I guess we've asked Ms. Manzi to go through some examples, an interactive spreadsheet, and this tax bill and property tax proposal deserves serious consideration by the governor and the legislature. So we feel it's very important that everyone gets to take a good look at this to make sure it's not transparent, and so that everyone can see what the impact of the homestead credit state refund would be. And also, one point on this is this would not also include any impacts from increased LGA or homestead or county program aid or township aid. So she's worked very, very hard on this and done a great job. So thank you.
Ms. Manzi, are we going to be able to see this on the screen above us? Or
I believe so.
Okay.
In just a moment.
It doesn't appear to us the TV is up there or on, so that's fine.
It'll be on in just a moment.
Okay.
I have to press some buttons.
Okay. And members, as she's getting this ready, one way I think to think about it...
Oh, I know how to do it. That's okay.
There's these three big buckets of money the state currently spends on property tax relief. There's actually five. Two are smaller. Renter's credit, which the governor's cutting, and targeting, which is smaller. We're not touching those, but we're taking the remaining three big buckets in current law of property tax relief dollars. They are market value credit, the PTR, or some people call it the circuit breaker, and then the property tax deduction on the state side only. And remember, most of people's property tax deduction takes place on the federal side. We're taking those three buckets of money that exist in current law and restructuring them based on ability to pay. So if you have high property taxes relative to your income, you're going to get more relief than if you have not nearly as big of a property tax burden. So that's how it plays out in a revenue-neutral way, to sort of physically target property tax relief to those who need it most in a climate where we cannot bring new revenue to the table. So, Ms. Manzi, that's really small. Can everyone see that?
Madam Chair, I think
Ms. Manby.
Right now you can see the whole thing. This is what will appear on your computer screen. And now what I'm going to do is to zoom into a portion of it so we can talk through it a little more intelligently.
Okay, Ms. Manby, can you tell everybody on the tape here, how can everyone at home and everywhere else do this? I'm not sure I knew where to direct people to try it out. Ms. Manby?
Madam Chair, this will be posted to the Property Tax Division webpage and to the full tax committee webpage this afternoon. If you'd like me, I can go through and show people where those webpages are, perhaps when we finish with the examples,
so they
can see right where there will be a link.
And I just say, because I've got a note that we're being televised, if anybody at home wants to try this, it's www.house.min. Okay, so you get onto the Minnesota House of Representatives website, and then you can find your way through committees, and you can get to the tax committee, and you can find this. So anybody in the state of Minnesota can try this out when it's posted this afternoon. Okay, Ms. Manby.
Okay, so this is the whole thing. I'll talk about the whole thing a little bit and then zoom in on it. The top box is the box where you enter the data for what the filing status is of your example homeowner, their income, their home value, their property tax on the homestead, and we've included a line for property tax on the cabin so you can see how that interacts, and then their number of dependents and whether or not they're senior or disabled. So that's what's happening in the top box. And then the bottom box gives you the results. It shows you how much of the various state property tax relief programs they qualify for under current law and under the proposal. And it also shows the interaction with federal income taxes of the changes in the proposal. So I'll go through when we look at that box. So first I'll see if this works to zoom in on the top box. Oh, that's really zoomed in.
Too much. No, that's great.
Is that good?
Okay. That's great.
Okay, so here is the top box. The first row is filing status, married equals one, head of household, which is a single parent, you enter a two, and single, you would enter a three in this box over here. So I have one entered already, for this is a married couple example. The next line is the income, and this is total income, so this is sort of roughly comparable to federal adjusted gross income, except that if you're doing a senior citizen example, you should include the entire value of their Social Security and not just the taxable amount, because the underlying calculations will factor that in as it goes through and figures the benefits. So this one has income of $60,000. This is close to the median for the non-metro Minnesota. The next line is for the home value. And this is close to the average for non-metro Minnesota for a typical homeowner. It's got $160,300. The next line is the property tax on the homestead. Again, this one is the average for a typical homestead in non-metro Minnesota, $1,492. Then this particular example, we haven't included any cabin property tax, so it's to start off with something simple. And the next row is the number of children claimed as dependents, and this is a married couple with two dependents. And the final box is for if either the homeowner or the spouse is senior or disabled. So you would enter a zero here if no one is senior or disabled, a one if it's a single person who's senior, or if it's a married couple with one over 65, and a two if it's a married couple and they're both over 65. If you try to enter something in one of these boxes that doesn't fit with the parameters, it will give you off to the right here, you'll see an error statement. So for instance, if you try to enter a filing status of six, which there isn't one, there's just married, head of household, and single, then it will tell you you've made an error and there won't be any results down in the bottom until you put something in that works.
Ms. Manby did this with me. I did it on myself, and I put in that my property taxes were $600,000, and it corrected me. So for folks who try it, it will correct you if what you put in was completely outrageous, and I did that in error. So that's right. Ms. Manby. Representative Rukavina.
going to wait like Representative Colson to go through the whole thing.
Yep.
I had a question on the cabin part of it.
Well, let's go through it. I just wanted people to hear Ms. Manzi's point that if you're trying it at home or anywhere else, it's going to correct you.
All right.
And we will get to the cabin part. I think actually maybe Ms. Manzi has a proposal with a cabin. Is that correct, Ms. Manzi?
We didn't
have one selected,
but we can certainly
we
add
can try one.
One. We can add
and,
one.
And most Minnesotans, of course, don't have cabins. I mean, the overwhelming majority of filers don't own a cabin. So we're trying to stick on average taxpayers right now. So Ms. Manzi.
In the space between the two boxes here, and you're not seeing the whole sentence there, but it puts in a, this is what, the very short explanation of the new refund program, where property tax in excess of 2% of household income is eligible for a refund. And then the next line tells you, based on this example that you've entered in the box above, what property taxes are as a percentage of household income. So for this example, the property taxes are 3% of household income. You see the little asterisk next to household income, which I'll talk about a little bit now. Household income used for the calculation of the new credit and for the current law property tax refund is taxable and non-taxable income, and then minus deductions allowed for dependents or for senior or disabled filers. So someone who has two dependents, for example, for tax year 2009 for a refund claim they would be filing next March or April, would get to deduct almost $10,000 from their income for their two dependents, because that's how it works. It's tied to the federal dependent exemption amount. You get 1.4 times that for the first dependent, 1.3 times that for the second dependent. So when you go into the Homestead Credit State refund schedule in this example, your income is $60,000, but your refund is being calculated based on household income of just about $50,000, because this person has the deduction for the two dependents. If they had more dependents, they would get larger deductions. The maximum you can get, maximum number of dependents you can get deductions for are 5, and at that point, the deductions total about $20,000. There's also a deduction allowed for senior or disabled homeowners that brings the household income down a little bit and puts you then in a little bit more favorable portion of the table. So moving down to the bottom part, which provides the result. We have a little screen issue there with some extra text. Oh, I see. The row is too tall there. Okay. I'll have to tell you what that row is or make it taller here for you. I'll tell you what that row is. I have everything in here protected except for the boxes where I want you to enter the data so that someone can't go into this online and change something by mistake and then make it useless to them and to everyone else who might be using it. But this goes through row by row, and these would show up if it wasn't the zoomed-in version, for what the current law programs are. The first line is the market value homestead credit, and for a home at the value listed up in the upper box, this is what the credit would be. The next row is giving the tax value of the property tax deduction at the federal level. So this is how much less you pay in federal income taxes as a result of being able to deduct the $1,492 from your taxable income. This taxpayer is, let's see, it seems like they're probably at the 15% marginal rate. The next line gives the tax value of the property tax deduction at the state level. Even though this taxpayer itemizes at the federal level, they're already being made into a standard deduction filer for state purposes because of the add back of the state income tax deduction at the state level. That brings them down to the standard deduction amount. So they do not have any tax value from our current law property tax deduction. The next line goes through and calculates their property tax refund under current law. Under current law, the property tax refund is going to be calculated on the $1,492 of taxes, which is their property taxes that are after that $228 of market value homestead credit is deducted. So you would go into the current property tax refund schedule with a household income of about $50,000, not $60,000, because you've deducted the amount for dependents, and you'd be going into it with a tax amount of $1,492, and you look in the instructions under income and taxes, and you come out at $46 of property tax refund. There's a zero for the homestead credit state refund in current law because that's the new proposal. And then this line is an interaction, which we'll see on one of the later examples, where if someone does lose the state property tax deduction, they have a partially offsetting decrease in federal income taxes, which I'll talk about a little more when we get to one of those. Then the bottom row here gives total benefits under current law of $502. So when we work through then proposed, in the first year, their market value homestead credit remains unchanged. The tax value at the federal level of their property tax deduction is slightly lower. Now the reason for that is that their homestead credit state refund, which we see down here, is $165. That's higher than their current law property tax refund. So the amount of property taxes that they get to deduct at the federal level will be lower, and as a result, the federal benefit to them of the property tax deduction will decrease. They don't have any, there is no property tax deduction allowed at the state level under the proposal, so that line is a zero. The property tax refund is eliminated and replaced with the new program. The next line shows the amount of refund they qualify for on the new program. Again, going into the schedule here with income of $50,000, but with taxes of $1,492 plus the $228 of market value homestead credit. So you go into the schedule and look up your refund with a higher tax amount, and then when you find the amount of your refund on the schedule, you deduct from it that $228. So as that $228 is phased out over time, for people who are eligible for the homestead credit state refund, the $165 will go up until they encounter the maximum for their income level. There's no federal income tax interaction for this example. And then the next row adds up the benefits under the proposal. Then off to the right, then it gives you the change amount. And off here, also on the right, is some more text giving a slightly longer explanation of the program, where you would qualify for a refund if your taxes exceed 2% of income and household income is less than $200,000. And then it provides the explanation of household income being income after the deductions for dependents or for senior or disabled homeowners. And at the very bottom, it gives a brief statement about the assumptions that are made in assuming itemizing and assuming a Social Security benefit. Taxpayers are assigned what the typical itemized deductions are for their income, for their age, whether they are seniors or not seniors. Seniors tend to have a different package of itemized deduction than do non-seniors. And for their filing status, married couples tend to have different packages of itemized deductions than do single filers as well. On Social Security, it assumes that senior taxpayers have the average Social Security benefits currently provided for their marital status. So that was the first example. And then I'll move on to the next example, which is the average for the metro area for a married couple with two dependents. So income is now going up to $80,000, which is close to the median for the metro area. Home value also goes up to $281,100, which is the average for a typical home in the metro area. The taxes are $3,030, and then we leave the two dependents in place. And when we go down to the results, under current law, we see that there now is a state tax benefit from the current law property tax deduction of $200. So that goes away from current law to proposed. However, this example is going to be qualifying for a larger homestead credit state refund under the proposal than they get under current law. So up here, we see the tax benefit at the federal level of property taxes going down because they're able to deduct less in property taxes at the federal level. Down at the bottom, we see the tax benefit of the income tax deduction at the federal level going up. this example taxpayer is losing $200 in state income tax benefits for the property tax deduction. When they do that, their state income taxes will be higher, and they deduct those state income taxes on Schedule A at the federal level. When you deduct more state income taxes at the federal level, your federal taxable income goes down, and your federal income tax goes down. This is actually kind of nice. I hadn't noticed it for this example, but it's pretty easy to do the math. This taxpayer is in the 15% bracket, so when their state income taxes go up by $200, their federal income taxes go down by $30, by the 15% of the $200. So those who are affected by the disallowance of the deduction are going to have a partially offsetting decrease in their federal income tax. And that, to get rid of that full screen thing. So then you get to the total benefits under current law and under the proposal, and again the change, and this example would have $227 more of benefits. And up in the middle, I kind of skipped over it there, but you see that this example has taxes that are higher as a percentage of their household income than did the non-metro example. Here they're 4.3% of household income. And I just have a couple more of these to go through. The next one is an example of someone who is going to not qualify for the new program. So here's a homeowner who has income of $150,000. Now that's below the maximum eligible for the program. They have a home value of $187,500 and taxes of $2,371, and they still have the two dependents. But you see in the middle that for this example, property taxes are 1.7% of household income. So their property taxes are not what the bill has defined as high relative to their income. So they are not going to be eligible for a credit. It's sort of the implicit value judgment that this household can't afford to pay that much in property taxes without assistance from the state. When you go through current law, you see that their market value homestead credit, this is the benefit they get at the federal level from their property tax deduction. This is the benefit that they're currently getting at the state level from their property tax deduction. So they're going to lose that. When they lose that $180 of benefit at the state level, their state income taxes go up, the amount they deduct on Schedule A goes up, their federal taxable income goes down because they've deducted more, and so their federal income taxes go down by an offsetting $45. So the change here, the loss, is the $180 loss of property tax benefits at the state level netted against the $45 reduction in federal income taxes. So the net effect on the taxpayer will be a $135 reduction in benefits. The next example we have we're going to go back to the average metro example. So we'll start with that. And 30-30. And we've got the kids there. The first thing we'll do is to take away the dependents, and then you see how the property tax as a percentage of household income changes. What we're going to do is transform this into a lower income senior couple. The first thing we're going to do is to reduce their income and give them just $40,000 of income. Now their property taxes are very high relative to their income. Not quite so bad when we take away the dependents, because when we take away the dependents, their household income is higher because that dependent deduction is not factored in. So they have taxes exceeding equal to 7.6% of their household income, and then we make them into a senior couple. And now they're up to 8.3% because they get a deduction for being senior homeowners, so their household income has now come down a little bit, and that's the household income as it's used to determine the refund amount. This example, their income is low enough and their itemized deductions are such that they don't itemize at either the federal or the state level. They qualify for the current law property tax refund, but they would qualify for a larger refund under the new program. So their net benefits are going to increase by $226. And I think that is the end of the examples we had planned out.
Okay, so to the Marquardt, and then it's going to be on questions now. Cole, Rukavina, Joe.
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, thank you. First of all, Ms. Manzi, thank you so much for putting this together. And again, we feel it is very, very important with a plan like this that I think should have serious consideration by the governor and the legislature, that it be very transparent, as Representative Earhart had mentioned last week, so that the public and legislators can look at how this would affect different scenarios, because there's different levers going on in this. But in short, as you saw here, is that, you know, the goal of the Homestead Credit State Refund is where your property taxes are high in comparison to your income, you're going to see benefits under this plan. And where your income is high in comparison to your property taxes, as you saw on the one, you're going to have reduced tax benefits. And that certainly is the goal of the Homestead Credit State Refund when you're looking at targeted dollars. Now, the two examples, the first two that Ms. Manzi did, were taking the average household income with the average value with the average tax rate in first rural Minnesota, and that was the $60,001, which came to a $101 decrease, 6.8%. And then the other one was the metro, which was $80,000, average household income, average market value, average tax, and that came to $227 of increased benefits, or a decrease of about 7.5% of the property tax there. So I think these should have given members a pretty good view of how things work, but I would strongly encourage all to go on, in the public, to also go on and see how this would impact you in these situations. But Ms. Manzi, thank you so much for putting all that together.
Yes, and I still want to thank you, Ms. Manzi, and all of the staff for the amount of work that's gone into this to make it as clear as possible for folks, because we all know taxes are difficult, and everybody's individually situated in the property tax system. That's inherently the complexity issue, is that everyone has a different income, everyone has a different property tax, everybody has a different market value. And this proposal takes all of that into effect, delivers property tax relief to those who need it most, and compares their ability to pay to the property taxes they pay. Representative Colt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions. I'm going to actually try to not ask some of them now, and I'll talk to Ms. Manzi offline. But Ms. Manzi, have you done anything to try to determine how many Minnesotans would qualify for some additional benefits under this proposal? In other words, how many Minnesotans today are paying more than 2% of their income in property taxes?
Ms. Manzi. Madam Chair, Representative Coles, unfortunately, we don't have a data set currently that links income data to property tax data. The income tax sample only provides us with property tax data for those people who itemize, and then what we get is their total property taxes, real property taxes that are deducted, which would include the amount deducted on a cabin or second home for those who have that. The Department of Revenue has done the estimates for this proposal using their tax incidence database with attempts to link that information. And their estimate has indicated that somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 to 550,000 homeowners would qualify for the new refund. And that's their estimate indicates that many would file to claim the new refund. I think they may assume that a larger number would qualify, and they haven't provided that in the estimate. So you may want to ask that question of the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, Ms. Manzi, do you know, instead of calling revenue up here, do you know how many households we count in that? I mean, what's the total number of households?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I asked Mr. Hines about that earlier, and there's roughly, just to keep this in round numbers, there's roughly 1.5 million homesteads in the state.
So just a little back of the napkin math, Madam Chair, it appears as though approximately one-third of the households in Minnesota would file for additional benefits under this proposal. So two-thirds of the Minnesota households under the current proposal would not see any additional property tax benefits. Is that, I mean, again, using round numbers, I'm not going to hold you to it.
Yep, that is fancy. Madam Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct. I don't think you should leap to the conclusion that the remaining would be affected negatively by the proposal. Some would be unaffected. Some don't qualify for the current property tax refund. Wouldn't qualify for this proposal and are not itemizers. So they would not be affected, and some will, you know, shift on to the program over time.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Manzi, there are some Minnesota taxpayers who will see less benefits. You had one example, so there. I don't like the term winners and losers, but we use it a lot around here. There will be winners, there will be some losers, and there will be some people who are unaffected. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Coles. In order to provide increased benefits to the people in those examples, someone has to be getting decreased benefits because this whole package is revenue neutral within the money that comes in through disallowing the property tax deduction goes back into replacing the current property tax refund and market value homestead credit with the new homestead credit state refund.
And Madam Chair, I'm getting close here. Ms. Manzi, how does a taxpayer go about applying for the refund? Is it done as part of their, when they file their income taxes, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, there's a separate refund claim form called the M1TR, where I'm kind of guessing that the Department of Revenue would retain the same form and use the new program parameters with it. That claim form is available at about the same time of year as the income tax materials are. It usually becomes available in January, and people have through August to file in order to get their refund in September under that program. So it's a separate form, and you have to wait until you have your property tax statement, which comes out in March, in order to file and claim it. And this, again, would be a question for the department. I believe that they send them out to people who claimed the refund in the previous year. Other people would have to go online to get one, or they would have to get one from their preparer or wherever else you get tax forms. I'm assuming that if this were enacted, there would be information in the income tax instruction booklet next to the place where you add back the property tax deduction that says you may be eligible for this new refund program. Here's where you go to get the form to claim it.
Okay, Madam Chair, one last question. Ms. Manzi, big assumption here, because I think in the current form the bill is destined for a veto. Obviously, it's not going to end up in its current form if it goes through conference committee, etc. Maybe we'll be able to salvage something. But assuming the bill passed and was enacted into law as is, when would somebody who's eligible for benefits under this new program first be eligible for those benefits? When would they see a refund check?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, this would start for taxes payable in 2009. So next March, when someone received their property tax statement, they would be able to get those M1TR form and fill it out and file it with the Department of Revenue, and they would then receive their refund check in September of 2009. Now, sort of the interesting part, very often when we do these things, we end up with things moving from one fiscal year to another, and it often seems to be that it's in ways that aren't advantageous for the new program. This one, it works out a little bit differently, because you won't get to have the disallowance of the state property tax deduction affect you until you are filing your tax year 2009 return, which you would be filing in April of 2010. So you would get the check for the increased new refund program in September of 2009, and then the disallowance of the property tax deduction would fall after that. And I assume that there may be some minor adjustment in the withholding tables or in people's estimated payments to take that into account, and that would probably play out over a few filing seasons.
So, Madam Chair, I said one more. This is truly is the last one, because I think Ms. Manning,
I just want to tell you there's about 15 people on the list, and we have caucus at 12, and it's a 200-page bill. I think, members, I'm just going to let you know we're going to be coming back tonight. Okay, so Rep. Semkolz.
Madam Chair,
I don't see how we can in any way get through it, so please.
I apologize, Madam Chair, but it's...
No, Rep. Semkolz, please don't misunderstand me. I want to be really clear. We want everyone to understand it, because actually your line of questioning tells me I don't think you're understanding it, and so we do want to have as much time as possible, but we all have caucus at noon, and this is one article of 15, and we have 15 questions on this provision, so I think folks who are here should understand that we'll be needing to come back after the floor session. Rep. Semkolz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I think I understand it quite well, and I want to make sure that the public fully understands it. But the last question I have, given the fact that there's nothing for 2008, so a taxpayer's not going to receive a check this year, they're going to get something, and if they qualify, maybe in September of 2009, which is into the next biennium. Ms. Manzi, if you look at the spreadsheet, can you tell the committee, tell the public, what the cost of this is, the quote-unquote cost, because that's the way we got to carry these things around here for the next biennium. So we're not, there's nothing that's hitting in this biennium, but we've got a fairly sizable number in the next biennium.
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I'll work through this, and I'll expect the fiscal analyst to help me if I stumble on finding the correct lines to reference you to. Okay. This is on page 4 of the spreadsheet. And this article is, I think, contained on lines 5, 6, and 7. And Cynthia is nodding, okay? So on line 5, you see in fiscal 11, that's the first year when the market value credit will be reduced. It will be at 60% of its current level in that year. So that's the savings from the phase down of the market value credit. On line 6, this is the increased cost of the new refund schedule. So in 2010, it's $206.7 million, and in 2011, it's $269.8 million. And that increases in that second year because of the because part of the market value credit phase out is shifted over to the new credit for people who are eligible for the program and who are not currently who are not capped by the maximum otherwise. The next line, line 7, shows the revenue savings through disallowing the state income tax deduction for property taxes paid, and that falls in fiscal 10 and 11. And then at the end, the combination for the 10 and 11 biennium shows a net revenue savings to the state of $700,000 over the biennium. And that was as close as we could get it to come out to zero without putting some weird percentages into the refund schedule. There's a lot of moving pieces, and we were trying to get to zero or slightly above, and that's where we landed.
Thank you,
Ben.
That was my last question.
No problem. I mean, take all you need. I really want people to understand it, because I think there's a number of things going on there that, you know, understanding taxes is not for the weak. So, I just want to be clear for folks who are following that line of questioning that there is nothing being taken, no property tax relief this year. The current program we have in Minnesota law now, the circuit breaker, the targeting, the renter's credit, market value credit, and the property tax deduction all remain in place. So there's no lag of year of no one getting some kind of benefit. So I want to be clear on that. There's no new way that somebody has to file for this refund that's different and confusing. It's the way it is in current law. It's the circuit breaker in current law. It's the exact same way. So that's not different. But to the question of, you know, are there some folks who will not get as much property tax preferences that they're currently receiving at courtesy of state taxpayers. That's absolutely true. Without new revenue brought to the table, we are absolutely targeting relief at those who need it most. Does that mean that somebody who's getting some money from the state who relatively doesn't need it gets less? Yes, absolutely. That's why the proposal is revenue neutral. If we threw in an income tax increase in there like last year, you can have everybody who relatively doesn't need as much property tax relief continue to get it. But because the governor won't go along with any more new revenue, as is previously stated by folks around here all the time, we have to make choices. So this proposal chooses to provide property tax relief to those who have high burdens. More than 2% of their income is going to pay property taxes. It does not favor those who are paying less than 2% of their income in property taxes. And we can just all think about who those people are. They are situated throughout the tax system. And the idea of property tax relief is to ease the pain from those who need it the most. It is not to say sort of a grandfather mechanism because you got some relief from the state once, not based on your income, based on something that's not related to your ability to pay it, but you're forever going to get it. That's the part of making targeted, surgical, selective choices with limited resources to, in a progressive way, assist those who most need it. And in fact, contrary to the confusion that might have been taking place there, that is most Minnesotans. Most Minnesotans will do the same or better under this plan than current law. And, you know, in division, I stated then, and I'd like to state it now, for folks who are listening and who are trying to think this through, for folks who are not as committed to a property tax relief based on the ability to pay, I guess I would call out to those to bring forward your proposals to address the embedded unfairness in the Minnesota Tax Incidence Report. The Minnesota Tax Incidence Report continues to say, we are becoming a more regressive state. We are less taxing our citizenry based on the ability to pay. And last year, the House Democrats tried to address that in two ways. One was to increase a progressive tax. That was the income tax. The governor said no. We also tried to decrease a regressive tax. That was a property tax. The governor said no. We're saying uncle, and we're saying, okay, governor, you don't want to over-rely on progressive taxes. But let's not over-rely on regressive taxes. So we are restructuring the current buckets of money. There is not one new dollar that is not in law right now being used to make this proposal work. It is saying, look, if you're getting a lot of tax benefits and tax preferences that relative to your economic situation you don't need, you're not going to get just as much tax benefit as you've been getting. But remember, the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans do better under this proposal, or there's no change. It's a very small minority of Minnesotans who will lose some of the tax preferences that they've been getting from the state. So there is an implicit statement, and it's found on, I believe it's line 13 of Ms. Manzi's calculation, that says if you are paying less than 2% of your income in property taxes, you're maybe not going to get as much as you've been getting. And I think people, when they think about it that way, can understand if you're under 2% of your income in property taxes, you're probably not needing state assistance. And that's what this proposal is attempting to address. So we have then Representative Mark Quick to that point. Otherwise, Representative Lucavina has been waiting.
Just one question, Mark Quick. Representative Coles, is the part on the number that under current law and under current participation rates would file, and it's about 550,000 as stated. This is not to say that many more do qualify for the benefit but have not or may not apply. There might be several reasons for that. Might be if you have a $10 refund coming back, you say, why do that? But in no way, shape, or form should what you insinuated is that there are many, many more than those 550,000 that would income qualify for this benefit. And we're hoping that the participation rate with this will increase dramatically. I mean, you should not have a program like the PTR where you have, you know, 50% participating, and to give the Department of Revenue a lot of credit. They've been working very hard to do that. But to say that the revenue numbers right now use $550,000 at current participation rates, that doesn't mean there are not many more that would qualify. And just one other point, Madam Chair, is this is a serious proposal. And I was disappointed to hear that within 50 minutes of this bill being laid out that you hear the word veto. I don't think you've had a good chance to look at this. The public certainly hasn't had a good chance to look at this. Before we get into the partisan rhetoric, just everyone settle down. This is a very serious effort that we think is governor-friendly. There are no tax increases. It is revenue neutral. It is progressive. And it targets those who need the relief the most, our senior citizens, our young families, and our farmers. So just, you know, at least let it be a couple hours old before we, I mean, let's take a good look at this. We didn't just throw this out in some partisan manner. Just please, Representative Coles and others, take a good look at this. Have your constituents go through these runs. You go through these runs. And just do that before you see this car that you haven't even test driven yet or looked under the hood, and you're sending it to the junkyard.
Madam,
I mean,
Madam Chair,
take a look at it. This is a serious effort. So, we can't even have a debate if you're already mentioning the word veto, and I'm saying this wasn't thrown out in any partisan manner. It is a serious approach to get property tax relief done this year. And so just listen to it. Give it some thought.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, if Representative Marquardt had cared to ask, my reference to the veto has a whole lot more to do with other provisions of this bill that the governor indicated last year when he vetoed the tax bill were reasons for the tax bill being vetoed, and they're back here in this bill. Representative Marquardt, it may be a serious proposal. I'm not debating that. I'm not disputing that. I may agree with it or not agree with it. I'm still trying to understand it myself. But this bill is chock full of veto bait. It may not be your provision, Representative Marquardt, but if you want a serious property tax proposal, let's pull it out of this big, giant omnibus bill that has at least a half a dozen items in here that the governor has indicated he's not comfortable with. And I can talk about it now, but Madam Chair, we have a lot of ground to cover here. Representative Marquardt, I'm not saying you don't have a serious proposal. I haven't made a judgment yet as to whether I believe it's a good proposal or not. But there's a lot of things in this bill, Representative Marquardt, that I have had a chance to look at in the last hour and a half, and there's a lot of problems with this bill.
So, Representative Coles, I appreciate that clarification because I'll tell you honestly, I thought you were referencing Article 1 as well when you talked about, you know, threatening the governor's veto. So I'm glad you clarified that's helpful because I think I have the same reaction that you were saying the governor went like this proposal, and honestly, I'd be a little stunned by that. But so I appreciate that clarification, and you're absolutely right. There's about 100 bills in here, and there's lots for majority members, minority members, and then the governor to both love and hate, and that's what an omnibus tax bill is. But we're on this article, and we really, I think it's. I agree with Representative Marquardt that, you know, making choices when you can't bring new revenue in a progressive way is difficult for people. I understand that. I put mine in. I would lose some of my tax benefits as an individual homeowner in Minnesota. And when we're not going to have new revenue, we're not going to have new investment. We can't just keep going out property tax relief to everybody, whether they need it or not. You know, I think those days are over in the short term. And so some people, like me, would be someone who would lose some of my current tax preferences. And my commitment to progressive tax relief to really try to ease the burden of folks who are paying more than 2% of their income in property tax relief is highlighted in this proposal. And does that mean every single Minnesotan is going to say yippee? Nope. And what is our responsibility here? With limited dollars, we have to give property tax relief to those who need it most. We could do it some states, too. They don't do any. They don't have circuit breakers. They don't have LGA. They don't do anything. We could do flat taxes. We could do poll taxes where, you know what, everyone just pays the same, and we just throw out the concept of progressivity. But House Democrats are committed to trying to get our tax system based on the ability to pay, and we feel that, you know, we are trying to work within the governor's revenue neutral, no tax increase parameters that he's laid out. So we're looking forward to seeing folks try to meet us halfway, and we do appreciate the questions very much, but I agree with Representative Marquardt, the rhetoric, you know, if we could just try to keep it down for a day or two, you know, we can all put the gloves back on and start punching real soon, but I think we do need to understand what's going on here. To that point, Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that point, you know, if we're trying to find a way to get property tax, real property tax relief to individuals, which I hear Representative Marquardt indicating that he would like to, and obviously on our side of the aisle we would too, why wouldn't we separate that provision out of your other bill? Would you be willing to do that, Madam Chair? Because it seems to me if we're seeking solutions, if we're seeking coming together on at least one of the provisions, why would we continue to bury that provision with all sorts of other things in the bill that may not be satisfactory in terms of coming together like maybe that provision might be?
Thank you for that question. That's a possibility. Yeah, that's a possibility. We're only on Article 1, so I sure wouldn't commit to saying, you know, we're going to delete after Article 1, but that's absolutely a possibility. I mean, we have to hear, you know, Representative Brown, that I've been disappointed this year that we've really not heard much from the governor's office at all. So I am sure that tomorrow we're going to get the list that Representative Cole just referenced, where we're going to have someone from the governor's office tell us all the things that are, you know, no, and they're a veto, and, you know, we'll get all that. It's a three-way dance with the House, Senate, and the governor, but I think that is absolutely something that may yet be coming before May 19th. So thank you for that, Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, if it's a three-way dance, I think our caucus is sitting on the bleachers waiting to get asked.
Well, we've got a lot of Representative Broad, and we're going to go then to Representative Rukavina. We do have a lot of minority members' bills in this bill, and some of those may be veto bait for the governor as well. So we'll be looking to hear how he responds to all the Republican bills that are in this bill. So we appreciate that. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Representative Broad, we were in the cheap seats way up there, not even in the bleachers, so, you know, when we were in the minority. And Representative Cole, is that Enron accounting practice the governor kept insisted he wanted that inflation thing in this bill? Because I think that was the main reason he used for vetoing the tax bill last year, was we wouldn't let him use that Enron accounting procedure that he, you know, where you count inflation on the revenue side but not on the spending side. But anyway, I'm to this point.
I had a question I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's not in the bill.
Representative Coles, it's not in the bill.
Yeah.
But you never know with an amendment. Who knows what will happen in markup? Representative Rukavina.
Because, Nancy, you've got cabin taxes up there, and is that just there for the computation because you could deduct it currently from your federal and then on the state income tax deduction, and now you won't? Is that right, sir?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, that's correct.
I thought maybe we got to deduct our cabin taxes.
Representative Bill.
Well, that kind of starts out on the question I had. So if you had a taxpayer, man and wife, who were filing two homesteads, would you lump those two together and put it on the first line where it said homesteads?
Just Andy.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to defer to Ms. Baker to see if that's possible under our current homestead practices.
Ms. Baker, I don't believe you can currently get a refund on two anyhow, so I don't think that's the direct comparison, but Ms. Baker, you know, you can't get a property tax refund on two properties. You can homestead,
you can homestead two properties.
Relative.
No. You know, a man and a wife can homestead two properties.
Oh, okay. I understand. Okay, I misunderstood your example.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Gill, I think what you're talking about is there is a few exceptions where you can have two homesteads, and one, for instance, is if your spouse works like over 50 miles away,
mm-hmm.
and that you can claim then two different homesteads. But I think you can only file for one property tax refund. And I'm not sure if you could add the taxes together for both of them. I don't think you could. I think you'd have to just use one of them.
And that was my
question. Yeah, I think we should ask the department how they do that, because I don't think there's a whole lot of those kind of instances. But the Department of Revenue, you know, probably has that. But I think that's what he's referring to.
Well, the reason I asked the question, Madam Chair, is just an example in St. Louis County. Mm-hmm. You've got a man and a wife that are two school teachers. And the St. Louis County School District from the Orr School to the Albrook School is 160 miles. So the teacher that teaches in Albrook lives in Albrook, and the person who teaches in Orr lives up in Orr, and they have two homesteads. And so my question is their homestead property tax could very easily exceed 2% of their income.
Mm-hmm.
Imagining if they were both making $50,000 a year, that would be $100,000 in joint income, household income. And then they both had property tax bills that were $2,500 each. So that would be $5,000 in property taxes against $100,000 in income. And so that's the genesis of my question. And then the second part of my question was, is what about if under the same set of circumstances, where a teacher worked in one school district and the spouse lives in another school district, but yet they were 45 miles apart and did not qualify for the second homestead. The homes they owned were 45 miles apart, and they had their second home as a residential non-homestead. And so that's my other question. Where would you add all those things in? I know those are a couple of technical questions. We might not have the answers, but just something that came to mind. And again, I have to tell you, Madam Chair, when you live up in a rural area where it's copious sums of district, my legislative district is 9,800 square miles. And so people have a little bit different challenges. So that's the genesis of the question.
And that's right, Representative Gill, and I agree you're pointing out that unique circumstance. And we can get some more information. It appears that folks need to think about this for a while, and we'll be coming back tonight, so we should know some more. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, for those who do own a seasonal recreational property, under this bill, you would no longer be able to deduct on your income tax the taxes you pay on that property. And so if Ms. Manzi were to show or put up some examples where people own seasonal rec, their overall benefit would be very different from these examples. Ms. Manzi, the examples you have, and thank you for doing that, by the way, talk about Pay 09. And, of course, in Pay 09, market value homestead credit is still 100%. And so you still show a benefit in the proposed column. But as we know in this bill, by 2014, it goes away. As the market value homestead credit starts going down, what effect is that going to have on the bottom line benefit or cost for these examples?
Ms. Manzi. Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, that is one thing that I do not have programmed into this spreadsheet, but I can tell you that if a person is eligible for the homestead credit state refund, and if they're not currently at the maximum for their income level, then the amount of market value homestead credit that they lose will appear as increased homestead credit state refund. And that's because when you calculate the homestead credit state refund, you look up your refund in the table. It will be a table in the instructions, and it's the table that appears in the bill. And then you take that amount and you subtract from it whatever market value homestead credit is allowed for that year. So as the amount of market value homestead credit that's allowed goes down over time, the amount of homestead credit state refund will go up dollar for dollar as long as the person is not up against the maximum for their income level. I think the example that is up here now is a senior couple with, I don't know if you guys can see that still or if I need to zoom in more, with $119 of market value homestead credit and $1,455 of homestead credit state refund. Based on my grasp of the table, I think that $1,455 is probably below the maximum for their income level. Mm-hmm. So when that $119 goes down to 60% of it, which would be maybe $65 in the next year, this top number would drop to $65 by whatever that is, $55, this number for the homestead credit state refund would increase by $55, so that the net to this person would be zero. They would simply be getting the money on their refund check that they got in September instead of having it appear on their property tax statement. And this of course would not happen to everyone, because not everyone who gets the market value homestead credit is going to be eligible for the new program. Some will have incomes that are too high, and some will have property taxes that are under 2% of their income. But I think you see what's going on with this if you look at the spreadsheet, because in the second year you start to see, the second year of the spreadsheet, you start to see the phase out of the market value homestead credit. And on line 5 there on page 4, you see that it's a savings of $97.2 million to the state. But then on the next line, which is where the new property tax refund schedule is, you see that that refund amount, the cost for the program, has jumped from $206.7 million to $269.8 million. And part of that is going to be growth in everything from one year to the next. But a big part of that is going to be these market value homestead credits phase out that's shifting onto the homestead credit state refund. So part of it gets picked up there, and it really will depend on whether the person is on the new program or not as to how that affects them.
Senator Lenny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand what you're saying, is that you cannot assume that your benefit is going to remain constant going into year 2, 3, 4, etc., that it may for some people, but for others it may change. You may have less of a benefit, you may have actually more of a cost increase in your income tax, and you can't assume that these examples for the first year are going to hold in years 2, 3, 4, and 5. Isn't that correct?
Well, in Repton Landing, that's the way it is right now. I mean, all of us, our incomes change year to year, our values change year to year, our property tax refunds change year to year, whether we qualify or not change year to year, our deductions, exemptions. So the property tax relief system currently is not meant to be static with the grandfather. It is meant to be dynamic and respond to people's individual situation as it relates to their burden. And quite frankly, it's not doing a very good job, because much of the relief, the market value credit and the property tax deductions, are relatively not based on income. And are sort of, you know, think of the LGA proposals, they're sort of a grandfathering effect that you would want to get away from in a dynamic analysis where you're consistently responding to individual situations. So you're accurate. I would agree that what you're saying is true, that these things will move around, but they do now, and they will continue to. But this proposal will be a better measure of ability to pay than the current system. But
Madam Chair, I certainly understand that every year our circumstances, individual circumstances, may change relative to income, etc. But this bill phases out the market value homestead credit. Mm-hmm. And so this bill says there is going to be a change in this formula in years 2, 3, 4, and 5. And so my caution to the public is, as you go through this model, please keep in mind this is only for the first year. And it may be different in years 2, 3, 4, and 5. And that's all I'm trying to make a point of.
Right, and I agree. And that's very intentional by design. That's exactly what we're intending to do, that it's linked to ability to pay, not value. Well, that's what the market value credit does. It links it to the value of your property, not to your income. So that's by design. Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I think we're just talking about my question. Beginning in 2014, no minimum guarantee. Unrelated to income is provided. That's what you were just
saying.
Beginning in 2014, no minimum guarantee unrelated to income is provided. That's what you were just talking about. Well, Madam Chair, beyond that, as I see the numbers that you're going to save here for the individual taxpayer, I think that in the back row up there are a bunch of tax preparers that are salivating at the idea of preparing the taxes for all those people out there who are not going to be able to understand this. And they can see that, in this case, it is rural folks, that $101 is about pay their fee. And, you know, we're really not doing much of anything. We're making a token effort in this thing, albeit it's a charitable, partisan effort to satisfy, as you were drawing the line in the sand when you started to feel about the governor and the VFL. I think that that's certainly maybe even an effort to dig a trench. Because I don't really say that this whole effort, moving everybody around, is worthwhile at $101 for rural Minnesotans who are going to pay the extra amount to have their taxpayer decide that they get the $101 back. But anyway, thank you very much.
Representative Earhart, and you know what, tomorrow in public testimonies, we'd love to hear from all those taxpayers, because actually I don't think it changes a thing for them. Earhart, if you use turbo tax and those kind of programs, which, you know, let's be honest, most filers do, you're not going to do the computation. You just put your income in, there it goes. If you're a standard deductor, there's no computation there either. So you're left with itemizers who might have very unique situations. So there's what we're all understanding here in the complex discussion is for we as tax committee members to understand it, but the actual person who's putting filing their tax returns is not going to be doing any of this. It's just Ms. Manzi has made a calculator so members and the public can see the differences under current law versus the proposal. And the fact remains that the majority of Minnesotans do better under the proposal. You know, is it complicated? Yes. But you know what's also complicated is just saying the current system is fine. And the current system is unfair. And that's complicated too. So without new revenue to hold everyone harmless, and we know that's how it works and everything around here, LGA, individual property tax relief, you know, education funding, you name it, the politically easy way to solve problems is to bring new money to the table so no one gets hurt as things change. And this is the serious proposal, not a partisan proposal, a serious proposal to the constraints laid out by the minority and the governor that there will not be new revenue. This is a $0 bill. Article 1 costs zero. Zero. And it reorganizes property tax relief based on the ability to pay. So, you know, is it complicated? Is it a change? Is, you know, yeah, that's true. But to do nothing is also true. It's also true to say we're just completely comfortable with the fact that tens of thousands of Minnesotans have a very difficult time paying their property taxes, that it is not based on the ability to pay, that there is no ability for many Minnesotans to do anything except have to sell their home ultimately because the state is not providing relief to those who need it most and is instead using quite a bit of resources providing property tax relief to those who don't need it nearly as much. And so the easy thing would be to bring the new money to the table. I don't feel I'm being partisan. I mean, I actually feel like on a personal level, it's kind of moving more toward my philosophy than last year's proposal, which was to bring all kinds of new revenue. So I personally am not doing this to be partisan. I'm trying to hear the folks that, you know, want property tax relief and the folks who don't want to spend any money and bring them together. And so, you know, I really hope we can be honest about what we're doing here, and then we can all vote on party lines if everybody wants to when it's over. But the proposal is not meant to be partisan in any way. And it just gets frustrating for folks to just say, you know what we should do then is do nothing. And we should just accept the fact that the tax system is continually getting more regressive year after year after year. And we should just stand by and do nothing. And I don't feel as a taxpayer I should be doing that. I feel it's my obligation to put a proposal out there. And if the governor vetoes it, you know, that's his call. He gets to do whatever he wants. But I'm not going to do nothing because it's difficult. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the market value homestead credit, I think Representative Lanning got to kind of the bottom of a lot of where I was looking at also. And I guess I would just ask Ms. Manzing if we, as this moves forward and we get into the out years, 12, 13, 14, is that tipping point going to be greater than it is in the beginning years for that? You know, there's been talk of about a third of the households will benefit, maybe 50% of the households benefit on this start of this. will that tipping point be greater or less as we move forward?
Ms. Andy. Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, there's actually a little twist with the market value homestead credit that we could probably talk about a little bit, that the property tax staff is more familiar with, but that credit begins to phase out when home value reaches $76,000, and it's totally phased out when home value reaches $414,000. So people in very high-valued homes don't qualify for that credit currently. Over time, the recent effect on the housing market notwithstanding, housing values will tend to increase. And as housing values tend to increase statewide, the market value credit that anyone receives on their home will be decreasing over time. So that is somewhat offsetting the phase out of this credit in this proposal. And that's happening in current law. If your home increases in value from $150,000 to $170,000, your market value credit the next year will be lower. And eventually, if the value increased enough, you would not have a credit. So that's just another piece of the puzzle that I think you should be aware of in looking at this. Now, the tipping point, there's really sort of two tipping points. One is if you're on the homestead credit state refund at all. If you're not, then you are simply going to lose your market value homestead credit in the future years, and that's going to be a loss of property tax benefits to you. If you are on the homestead credit state refund program, then the tipping point is how close are you to the maximum? And if you can add your current market value homestead credit onto the new homestead credit state refund and not be at the maximum for the program, then you should be indifferent to having the market value homestead credit or the new refund. You actually probably should prefer having the new refund because the new refund is going to maintain that and increase with inflation as the maximums increase with inflation.
Thanks.
While the market value homestead credit is seeming to phase out over time as home values increase with no kind of adjustment for growth. So that's a long answer, but it's a complicated topic.
Just one follow-up. Would you see this being beneficial or non-beneficial if we have decreasing property values? With the downturn in the economy, with the downturn in the housing market, if we see a decreasing valuation, how will that affect us?
Well, Ms. Representative Simpson, I think it's really driven by income, though. So your property values do come into play, but it's just getting more toward income. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, if we had decreasing property values, then people's market value homestead credit would tend over time to remain the same or perhaps to even increase slightly if their home value decreased. On the other side of the equation for the homestead credit state refund, that's a function of property taxes relative to income. If all property values are decreasing, then unless the local levies also decrease, the property taxes relative to value would have to decrease and end up staying roughly the same relative to income if income was staying the same. So the value going down by itself is only going to affect the market value homestead credit and not necessarily going to affect the other pieces of the computation.
Representative Simpson.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I think one point that should be made here is it appears, and there's no way, and I'll ask Ms. Manzi to answer this question, you know, what percentage of Minnesotans do better or the same under this proposal? It appears to me there's no way to know right now, because you can't look at every single individual homeowner's income, you know, and know at any given time, is it 2% of your income? I mean, we can all certainly think of our own lives, and there are times relative to income levels and situations and deductions that 2%, we're over 2% or under. But it appears to me one way to think about this is, you know, I think this proposal has about 75% of Minnesotans doing either the same or better. But the question is, if you're not bringing a single new dollar to the system, and we're not, there's no tax increase, this proposal is worthwhile even if only 10% of Minnesotans do better. That's the goal of progressivity. Now, if you're rooting for regressive taxes, you don't want to help anyone do better based on their ability to pay. But this proposal would be warranted and should be implemented even if only 10% of Minnesotans did better. Because the idea being, without bringing a single new dollar to the table, you are making the unfair regressive property tax system fairer. So it's not about trying to get to 100. I think it actually gets, you know, 75% of people probably are doing the same or better. But it'd be worthy if it was 5%, 10%, 20%. And it's significantly past that. Ms. Manzi, could you guess, I guess, without knowing, what percentage of Minnesotans will either do the same or better under this proposal?
Madam Chair, I think I would like to punt on that and maybe bring you something this evening. I have a lot of numbers swimming in my mind right now. What I can tell you is that one of the ways to look at this is to do a little thought experiment and to mentally group taxpayers into different clumps. And I don't want to, I will try to get something to you on that for this evening. But we did go through a little thought experiment starting with income and property taxes and not considering the effect of the market value homestead credit, because that brings in home value, which is another variable. But when you look at income and property taxes, if you have property taxes that are more than 2% of your income and your income is under $200,000 and you claim the standard deduction, you will get more relief than you get under current law. If your income is under $200,000 and you itemize, we don't know what will happen in your particular case. We can do examples to illustrate that, but some people under $200,000 with property taxes that are more than 2% of their income will do better, and some people will do worse, and it will depend on what their particular package of items are. If your income is over $200,000 and you claim the standard deduction, which there are people in that income range who do, then there will be no change for you on the credit and the refund part. If you itemize and your income is over $200,000, then you will pay more in state income tax as the property tax deduction is disallowed. If your property taxes are less than 2% of your income, then the proposal has implicitly decided that you are in less need of state assistance. However, if you pay less than 2% of your property, of your income in property taxes, and you claim the standard deduction, then you have no change. If you, and that's again setting aside the issue of the market value homestead credit, because we didn't put home values into this. If you pay less than 2% of your income as property taxes and you itemize, then you will have an increase in state income tax as a result of the disallowance of the property tax deduction. So those are sort of the boxes that you can put people in to think about, and maybe that clarifies it a little bit. We know for some of those boxes pretty much how many people are in it, and other of those boxes we don't know, and I don't think we have the data to know.
Okay, so I think we have Representative Earhart. One other way for members to think about this is if you were going to decide how much the state of Minnesota is going to give, let's say Representative Rukavina's committee, if you were going to say the state of Minnesota is going to give this much relief to kids to get to college, you would give it to everyone you could if you had unlimited resources. But if you don't have unlimited resources and you're not going to bring new revenue to the table, you have to pick which kids are going to get assistance to get to college. And it's going to be based on their ability to pay. And that's the work that Representative Rukavina's committee does every day. If in Health and Human Services you don't have all the revenue you need and you're going to decide who is going to get food stamps or who is going to get health care, you have to pick based on ability to pay. In the property tax relief system, we're doing a little bit there, but we're not nearly doing as well as we could. And this proposal highlights that in a revenue-neutral system, you can provide significantly more progressive property tax relief with no new dollars by making different choices and not implicitly saying that everybody is going to get assistance from the state who relatively doesn't need it. Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I find it hard to believe that people earning over $200,000 don't itemize. If they don't, they should get some tax help.
Representative Earhart, are you volunteering your services?
No.
Do you have a question for Ms. Manzi? No. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I think it'd be helpful for Ms. Manzi to put some of those numbers together, because I talked about a little bit in property tax division, you know, 33% don't even, you know, they do the standard itemization and so forth, but the bottom line, again, and Representative Winchevsky has mentioned this, is that the whole idea is, with limited dollars, is, you know, and this is just this year's book, Madam Chair. I didn't have to bring the thick one, which was from last year, so it's just from this year. It's probably over 1,000 total comments. And as you look at the fact that there can be no new taxes, that needs to be revenue neutral, no new money is put into the system, you say, how can we solve the concerns of folks like this? And so you look at a system that's going to target the most relief to those folks who need it the most. Those who have had the most pain will receive the most gain under this program. And, you know, you're going to have those that are going to benefit a lot. You're going to have those that are going to benefit some. And you're going to have those that are going to have reduced benefits as you work within the system. But I would agree with what the chair is saying, in that there's going to be a lot more that will benefit than won't. And and let's just go back to a second to the itemized deduction on the income tax. In that is not fair to those who need the most. And I want to give this example, if I can, very quickly. But let's say we both have, Representative Earhart, you and I both have a house or a home that has $3,000 of property tax on it. And let's say my household income is $150,000. I'm going to be in the 25th percent on the federal deduction, and I'll be on the 7.05 on the state deduction. My total deduction is going to be $960 on that $3,000 property tax. If you make $50,000, you're going to be in the 15% deduction category on the federal and 5.35% on the state. Your benefit's going to be $611 deduction. You and I, living in the same home, same property amount, I'm going to get $960 benefit. You're going to get $611. That's not progressive. It's not fair. And that's one of the things that we correct in all of this. And, you know, you get back to that market value homestead credit. That is a system that has nothing to do, for the most part, with income. There was no real policy decision when it was put in 2001. There wasn't any real policy. The reason it was put in, to try to lessen the impact of the shifts at the time onto some of those property owners. That's basically it. But in and of itself, if we do nothing with this program, in 20 years it eliminates itself. Market value homestead credit right now is being reduced by $13 million a year. It's about $260 million. In 20 years, if market values go up, it eliminates itself. So what we're doing is taking a program that is not based on income, a program that is dying, a program that's being eliminated, and putting it in, restructuring it to a more efficient, targeted homestead credit state refund based on people's ability to pay. And as Ms. Manzi mentioned, if you qualify for the homestead credit state refund, here's a dollar-for-dollar exchange there. And so, it all comes back to that 2%. And we're saying that 2% should be a level. That should be an amount that creates fairness and gets relief to those who need it the most. So I think this has been good discussion. I know we'll have more tonight, but it's, we look at how we could seriously put something together and represent De La Forest, and I had a little conversation the other night. It is, you start with a system and you're trying to move this rock along, and it's difficult no matter what you do. And when you talked about last week or the week before about eliminating the property tax, well, what a great discussion. And, you know, it's all these things and how we can, we need to look at things differently, because the way things are going right now, and that, I've spouted the statistics on how property taxes are going up, it just is not working right now. So at least we can get a start to target those who need it the most, to help those folks stay in their homes. And it's a
It's changed. There's no doubt about that. And there's going to be an ebb and flow on all of these things. But, you know, I think it's worth a good effort to, you know, see what we can do on this.
I think we're going to get to the Article 2. one last comment, just as we're all, and this is not partisan, because I think Democrats in the room and Republicans are trying to understand this, and hopefully people at home and in the audience are trying to understand this. One last way to think about this. There are three big buckets of property tax relief in current law that we're taking all that money and we're reorganizing. One of them is very progressive. It's the PTR. Current career breaker, very progressive, true and great. Next one is market value credit. Not progressive, based on the value of your home. Not based on the ability to pay. Third one, your property tax deduction off your income tax on the state side, very regressive. The wealthier you are, the more you get. So of these three big buckets that are attempting to provide property tax relief, one of them is going counter to progressivity, one's helping progressivity, and one's kind of working around value. This is taking all three buckets, throwing them back into the pot, and distributing them in a progressive way. Now, if you don't like progressive taxes, and that's not your philosophy, you should vote against this proposal. No question. If you're kind of rooting for regressivity, you know, stick with current law. If you want a regressive property tax system, just stick with current law. And that's a legitimate discussion to have. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't think, you know, at least the current majority has made any allusions and has ever said anything other than we support progressive taxation. So this should come as no surprise to anyone. I will tell you that, in fact, most folks who are even conservative support progressive taxation, and most academics from conservative to liberal support the concept of progressive taxation. So if you don't like it, I mean, I understand that. There's nothing with that. But don't misunderstand that it's taking only the dollars that are in the system now, not one new dollar is being added, and it's redistributing it in a more progressive way so that those who are having bigger burdens relative to their income are getting more relief. Representative Earhart.
Well, Madam Chair, I think, wouldn't you consider the market value credit progressive, since as our home values go, it's eliminated from the calculation?
Representative Earhart, I think because it starts at such a, the first chunk, it's, you know, you get up to a certain point and then you go. Well, there is some element that we can ask Miss, I don't know if it would be Miss Baker or Miss, or who would want to talk all about how the market value credit works as far as regressivity versus progressivity. However, it is not tied to income, and it is going to disappear as values. We're already seeing that. I mean, if you look at where market value credit was brought in and who, and you know this, Representative Earhart, in your district, who it was giving assistance to, that's not going on anymore because values are rising past it. So the folks who are, and it will eventually disappear, that it will be completely gone. So, Ms. Manzi, did you want to take a shot, or Ms. Baker, or Mr. Michael? I mean, does anybody want to answer Representative Earhart's question on?
Madam Chair, it was about 700 and some thousand that my area was getting, and now it's down to about half of that in the market area because the values have grown.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's progressive.
Oh,
the values grow, you are eliminated from the program.
Well, Representative Earhart, it's going to completely just plain old go away. But maybe Mr. Michael, does someone want to jump in on here? Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee there, my guess is that if you analyze the market value credit in isolation, that it would have a loosely progressive distribution because of the correlation between income and home value. That relationship, though, is sort of accidental and not intentional because it's simply based on the market value of the home. And so you can have a person who has a very high income but consumes very little housing and has a low home value, and they will benefit. And you can also have the converse situation where you have somebody with a lower income, but because they've been lucky enough to be in a home that's increased in value, will not get relief under it. And that's why I would say that the relationship is sort of, I don't know if accidental is the right word, but incidental is sort of, there's a correlation there, and so it probably is, it is correlated, I'm sure, because home value is correlated with income, but it's not a strong correlation And obviously the property tax refund is an explicit relationship between the two.
Representative, I can't read that writing.
It's me.
It's Broad, I see, but someone is ahead of you, but I don't know who it is, so rest of Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had actually three questions for Ms. Manzi, but in regards to the regressive versus progressive taxes, you know, just wanted to put on the record that our side of the aisle has tried to make the tax system less regressive by voting against regressive gas tax increases, by trying to lower the corporate tax, which we've tried to do over and over again, and by trying to lower the sick tax. And so where our difference comes in, I think, is that while one group is saying we've got to increase taxes to create a progressive system, we're saying we've got to lower regressive taxes to create a more progressive system. Very different approaches to the same problem. But my questions really are threefold for Ms. Manzi. I'm trying to understand the 2% number and where that actually comes from. Is that a standard out there that is pretty typical? Is that something that we just created? Why 2%?
Ms. Manzi. Madam Chair, Representative Broad, you're talking about the 2% threshold of income?
Yes. Ms. Manzi.
That was selected by Representative Marquardt and Representative Lankowski. It's the threshold toward the bottom end of the current property tax refund schedule. We wanted to, and it also has been talked about in several bills introduced specifically relating to senior citizens in recent years. And I think what they wanted to do was to just have a flat income threshold for all incomes that are eligible for the program, rather than having something like the current property tax refund structure where the threshold increases from, I think, 1% to 4% depending on your income. And it's a little more difficult to explain, and it has the effect of diluting the benefit for middle-income taxpayers, homeowners who are eligible for the program. So I don't think there's anything particularly magic about the 2%, but that's what's there.
Well, Representative Brown, I'll answer that because we authored it. And there is no magic. You could go to 1. You could go to 3. But the idea of some minimum individual effort. I mean, you know, remember the local government aid debates of past, and we're going to get to those yet when we get to Article 2. You know, the idea that there should be some local minimum effort of taxation so that if, no matter where you live in the state, you know, you should have a little skin in the game as an individual taxpayer so that you don't have, you know, every bit of the local property tax coming from the state. But so that's the same concept here, that there ought to be some, you know, minimum level of income that we would expect Minnesotans to contribute for their local or to their property taxes. But we could definitely pick a different number, and it would have, and then it would change everything. So that's been brought.
And Madam Chair, that's what I was trying to get at. I mean, I recognize the idea of consistency in a set number. I think that makes sense. You know, in regards to 2%, what I was trying to figure out is there some type of economic rationale in terms of what people spend on certain parts of their purchases, or if there's some real number out there that guided that, and I'm hearing that the answer is not exactly. But my second question, I'm just wondering in this redistribution program, property tax redistribution program that we have before us, whether the estimates, the revenue estimates, include the market slowing, the slowing of the market. And I don't know if that's for Ms. Manzi or if that's for somebody else that we can just get to later. I just want to understand the interaction of the market. One of the challenges that I'm having, I think maybe it's not just me, maybe it is, but just all these interactions, whether it's the income tax interaction or whether it's how much business property you have in your community, what do all these interactions mean? So I don't know if Mr. Wilson later on can help me with that question. My third question, Madam Chair, I know we're getting to the end, is that I'm just looking to see if there was an estimation done regarding how many people are pushed into the next tax bracket through these changing interactions between the property and the income tax. If there's any way to determine who's moving where on our income tax system through this new redistribution program.
Representative Brown, I think that's a great question, and we should try to get the answer to that. And I think you're right, Dr. Wilson, or someone from Revenue can talk about your previous question, but the income tax bracket issue, and we'll let someone tell us later, but my understanding is, think about this, if you're losing your deduction on the state side, you know, you're getting some benefit as a result of that on the federal side, because your liability is going up, so your property tax deduction gets larger. So I don't know how it all interacts, but you're tracking what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, I do track what you're saying. It just seems to me that in some cases we're going to have the offset will not be enough to not slide you into the next bracket. And so I'm just trying to get a sense. It seems to me that we ought to be able to project who's moving where through these interactions, and that's just, I'm just trying to get a sense of what's going on.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Representative Brown. This is what's really hard, and it's going to be hard when we come back on Article 2 with local government aid and formula changes, because the hard thing with all this stuff is predicting when you change something for sure what will happen, which is, of course, impossible. And so, part of the reason we know as much as we know is because we have a system so we can make some extrapolation. To change something in a more progressive way, we're not going to be exactly accurate, but we know it's going to get more progressive. Similarly, if you change like the LGA formula, it's very difficult to know for sure what will happen, but you have to make educated guesses, and sometimes it's better to, in my mind, this is how I think about it, is to have the philosophy and try to implement it and then see what happens. And in general, when you base taxes on the ability to pay, it flows through the tax incentive system and it does make the system more progressive. I mean, that's pretty empirical. But to the individual person, you know, I don't know, and I think if Ms. Manzi could at least give us a preliminary answer as to what we might be able to see tonight or tomorrow, or who in revenue might be able to help us out to answer Representative Broad's questions. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I think that the changes in property taxes in future years that are built into the homestead credit state refund calculation would be the same assumptions that are made under the February forecast for current law property taxes. So it's, in that sense, as Ms. Templin reminded me, it's a static estimate. They aren't assuming, I don't believe, any changes in property tax levies or anything like that as a result of this proposal and part of the estimate. But the underlying property tax forecast would certainly be modeling however they, and I'm not familiar with how they do that at revenue, but it would have what the expectations are about economic changes built into them, just as the current law projections do.
Okay, thank you. Representative Marklett, and you know we're going to recess, and then we'll go to our caucuses.
Representative Marklett. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And to add to what Chair Lentesky said in response to Representative Broad, is kind of the 2% level. On the tax incident report of 2009, if you look at homeowners' growth, it goes from 5.4% of your income in the first decile all the way to 0.6%, goes down to that in the top 1%. But the ones in the middle, like 4th, 5th, and 6th decile, are 2.5, 2.7, 2.5. So we thought, with the money available, you know, if you had $1 billion, you could lower it to 1.5. But it's kind of the dollars available, and we were able to get down to 2% because we feel that would, the rates are 2.5, 2.7, it would help in that regard. And kind of one other offshoot of this, if you will, is we really think it simplifies things in concept, where now a property taxpayer says, you know, how much am I going to pay roughly? You know, boy, it's my market value, it's whatever this might be. Now they basically have a 2% level. Roughly, if you're around 2%, that's what you're going to pay. And the income amount is $200,000. So it's kind of, you know, for this program, 2% under $200,000. And so we think it might actually simplify the system a little bit, but just in response to what you had mentioned.
Okay, so we do have representatives. Members, before you do, we do go, if you can put everything back in your folder so that we can continue walking to the bill when we come back. Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would just say that on our side, we're interested in property tax reform, and I'm glad to see this discussion is happening. If the majority has any more information that they can get to us as far as graphs or spreadsheets that you've gotten from Mr. Michael, I think it would be helpful for us to have those. So appreciate it.
And I'm not aware of anything beyond this, but Ms. Manzi, do you have other things you could provide all of us? And I should say, you know, members, I know it's a complicated one, but we did, and I really appreciate working with Representative Simpson. We released all the information we have to everybody within a half hour of everybody else. So, and I don't have anything else that I'm aware of, but if Ms. Manzi has something she can provide the committee with, as Representative Simpson has asked, I would be appreciative of that as well. Ms. Manzi?
Madam Chair, I just wanted, back when we embarked on this, I said that I would show everyone where this was going to be on the website. So that's what I'd like to do here in just 2 minutes. So I'm from the House page, you click on committee information, and this lists all the committees, and taxes is down near the bottom because it's alphabetical after all of the finance committees. And there it is. There's taxes and there's property tax division. If you go to the taxes page, this item will be a new bullet right down there below subscribe to the taxes committee mailing list. There will be a new bullet there that will say something like calculate property tax relief under house file, whatever our house file number is, and you will click there and it will take you to that spreadsheet and you can do examples to your heart's content. And if you have any questions about any of them, please give me a call or send me an email and I can do my best to help you interpret what is happening in the example. It will also be listed on the property tax division page. There's a similar list of bullets and it will be added as the last bullet there, and it will be available, I would say, probably in early to mid-afternoon.
Okay, so Ms. Manzi, we all have our homework assignments, and everybody who has access to a computer today needs to go and look for this, and then that way in committee we'll have a better discussion because everyone can put their own situation, their moms and their cousins and everybody, and kind of figure it out. And so we'll all do our little homework assignment. Representative Zeller.
Well, that, I was just going to ask Representative Broad, so we would maybe be allowed to bring our computers then so we can get you an email and I can know that.
Although we do have to do the rest of the bill. Okay, so thank you for that, Representative Zeller. We are in recess.
Madam Chair, let's start with Article 9.
Okay, so we're going to do the walkthrough with the staff on Article 9. Mr. Michael.
Article 9 is an adaptation from the Department of Revenue's bill, which updates the Internal Revenue Code references in all of the non-income corporate and estate tax chapters and links them to Chapter 289's definition of the Internal Revenue Code. So in the future, when we update that reference, then all of these will automatically be updated. None of them really involve provisions that have cost items.
Mr. Michael, so for folks who are following along, we're on page 45 of the summary and page 46, is that right?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We're okay. Now moving along to page 48, which is the Department's Individual Income and Corporate Franchise article, which, if the committee remembers, these were the provisions that the department recommended in its bill. There are no changes to those, but we added to it two provisions that were requested by the Department of Revenue and by business interests. One relates, and this is in Section 7, to the new independent contractor withholding provision that was in Chapter 154. That provision applied to both the contractors and to both filers. Both the department and the businesses that are in the bulk filing business requested deletion of the bulk filers from that provision, and so that's what this does. Section 8 relates to the new requirement that non-residents who receive deferred compensation that was earned in Minnesota but received while they're a non-resident pay tax on it. There's an associated withholding requirement that goes with that. In Chapter 154, that withholding requirement was made effective April 1. The bill delays that till January 1, 2009, and again, that was a request from the Department of Revenue and the large employers in the state. Article 11 is, again, from the Department of Revenue's bill as requested by them, and I do not believe that we made any deletions from this, except that the federal update provisions were moved to that separate article and were done in the way that I described for that article. Section 12 is similarly the provisions from the department bill for special taxes and fees. This includes the changes for the Minnesota care tax and the gasoline tax and so forth. The author's amendment has a small change in one of these provisions that was requested by the Department of Revenue that we'll describe tomorrow when we go through the author's amendment. Article 13 has the department's property tax
and age provisions. There were a number of provisions that were deleted from this article because they were enacted, or that provisions that were inconsistent with them were enacted in Chapter 154. For example, the wheelage tax provisions were deleted because Chapter 154 eliminated that provision that tried to coordinate that with levy limits. Most of these provisions are, again, as you recall from the department going through them, fairly technical. Article 14 is the department's miscellaneous provision, and in this there is one change that, if you'll recall, Representative De La Forest raised questions about the revenue recapture provision, which is in Article 14, Section 4, and in response to that, we contacted and talked to the Department of Revenue, and that has been redrafted to address how that, to clarify and address the concern about how that notice goes out to the debtors. And this is an instance where the department, as the collector of state debt, is exercising the powers under the Revenue Recapture Act in order to collect additional state debts, but is not really the creditor.
So, Mr. Michael, is the De La Forest, did you say that was Section 4?
Correct.
Thank you.
And that was amended after discussions with the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
Article 15 is the miscellaneous article. This contains, from the governor's budget recommendations, the surplus lines insurance provision, which requires this insurance, which is sold by companies that are not licensed in Minnesota to write insurance. They're licensed in a foreign country, to requires that the sellers of that insurance have those policies stamped. This is a way that the department expects that additional insurance premium tax will be collected as a result of this. In addition, this article also contains the minerals provisions. There are three of them. In Section 4, there's a five-year suspension of the investment tax credit that applies to mining companies under the production tax. Section 5 dictates how that revenue that otherwise would have gone to the mining companies will be used for special projects on the range that are delineated as being for community development, public facilities, economic development, renewable energy, and diversification of the range economy. Section 6, the last section of Article 15, provides that in calculating the escalator for the production tax for production in 2009, it will be the greater of whatever the regular escalator is, or 10 cents. The Department of Revenue is estimating at this point, it's unclear exactly what the escalator will be, but their best estimate based on a forecast of the implicit price deflator is that it will be about 7 cents. So this would in effect be a 3 cent a ton increase in that tax. And with that, after having done the last five articles, we'll go back and have Pat do Article 2 and then start back the rest of the way.
Mr. Michael, if I may, could you do Article 8 anyhow while you're there?
Article.
Is that something you were going to do, mortgage and deed?
No, actually, Karen was going to do
that. Oh, you just told me you.
I'm happy to do it if she wants to, but let's have Pat do it instead of personal.
Okay, well, we were waiting for members to get in here, and still most of them, half of them aren't here.
Okay.
So that's why Article 7 and 8 could be picked off.
People might want to talk about the mortgage and deed taxes for the... I will go through Article 8 on special taxes.
Okay.
Section 1 is Representative Morgan's bill that exempts more categories of two-wheeled vehicles from the wheelage tax. Section 2 is Representative Yaros's bill that provided an exemption for nonprofit organizations that have disaster response vehicles like the Red Cross. Section 3 is, I believe, Representative Morrow's bill that provided a motor vehicle registration tax exemption for spotter trucks. These are the trucks that are not used on the highway but are used to move the semi-trailers around warehouses and so forth. Section 4 is the Department of Vehicle Services or the Division of Vehicle Services request to change the intra-city bus registration tax calculation so it will free up a couple of more vehicle categories. Sections 9, 10, and following are the reinstatement of the Hennepin and Ramsey County mortgage and deed tax and the associated provisions that permit spending of those proceeds. Sections 13 and 14 are the St. Louis County mortgage and deed tax, the Dakota County mortgage and deed taxes, and sections 15 and 16. 17 and 18 are the Anoka County mortgage and deed taxes, which those are all very familiar, I believe, to the members of this committee. The St. Louis County one, for those of you who were here when Representative Bill presented his bill the other day, this is the original version that was in the vetoed tax bill, not the version that Representative Bill presented the other day that had the dedication of the first use of those monies for a waste disposal system on the North Shore.
Okay, thank you for that. Ms. Dalton, before we go to Article 2, can you do Article 7? I believe that's all for you. This is the governor's provision. Pretty straightforward.
Madam Chair, Article 7 can be done, I believe, in one line. It's basically dealing with the June accelerated payments, and they are in the first tax bill, we raised the percentage paid on an accelerated basis from 78 to 80%. This bill raises it from 80 to 85%.
Okay, thank you for that. So that was very efficient, members. We've done Articles 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. And if you didn't cross the street fast, well, you missed it. Ms. Dalton, Article 2.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Article 2 is the aids and credits article. It is a big chunk of it is exactly like what was in the property tax division report. It has $20 million extra county program aid. It has a new town program aid of $3 million, a one-time grant of $1 million to help cities with home foreclosure costs, and it provides a study for general aid. The difference is instead of a $30 million increase to LGA, there is now a $50 million increase to LGA under this bill. And there have been modifications made in the formula from the property tax division report so that the formula spreads the money in, you know, roughly the same percentages that had been spread when we only had a $30 million appropriation. There is a new one that was just handed out. It is called Comparison of Projected Baseline 2009 LGA with the LGA under House Bill 3149 with the author's amendment. There was a slight change between what the bill.
Can you make sure we all have it? Does everybody track that? Because we have two. Now we have a new one. So you have two in there. You got to find the right one.
Yes.
And so it says House Bill 3149 with author's amendment.
Yes.
So we got that?
With the author's amendment, and then the difference between what's in the bill and what is in the author's amendment is actually in the italics. Under the original bill, there was a modification that said the new jobs aid base is going to be reduced by the lesser of $1.2 million or what the city got in regional center aid. That's taken a little bit too much money out of some regional centers, and so it has been adjusted down, so it's taking out the lesser of half of a city's regional center aid or $1.2 million. The other changes from the property tax division report is that the $8 per capita for small city aid base has been increased to $9 per capita. The $18
Mandy, where, Ms. Dalton, where are you now on the summary?
Not on the subject.
Okay. That's okay. The reason I'm just blowing it down here a minute is because a bunch of members don't sit on the division, so they don't know what the division did. So I think for everyone to understand, we don't want people to not understand what the LGA proposal is and what the LGA formula
is. I will go back to the summary.
Okay, so we're on page 5?
We are on page 5 of the summary.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Most of these provisions actually came out of what was called the Unity Bill that was proposed by the city. There is a minimum need measure for large cities in Section 1 of $290 per capita. That came out of the Unity Bill. Beginning in 2010, each city's revenue need will be averaged using 2 years' worth of data. This replaced a volatility fix that had been in the original bill that passed earlier this session that doesn't quite work now that we've got these other little pots of money. The city aid base, we eliminate an obsolete reference to an expired city aid base increase to Coon Rapids, and then we provide extra aid base to Browns Valley and Crookston, which were in the veto tax bill last year, and to Mendota and to the city of Excelsior. And the reasons are listed there. The other thing we do is we eliminate the $6 per capita of extra city aid to small cities. This was replaced with the new small city aid base in Section 3 at $9 per capita. This had been $8 per capita in the division report. The other really new piece which came out of the Unity Bill is the city job space. It's a separate pot for all cities with a population of 5,000 or more. In the division report, it had been $18 times the jobs per capita in the city times the city's population. This has been increased to $30. And as I said, the job space is reduced for any city receiving regional center aid by now the lesser of half of its regional center aid or $1.2 million. No city's job-based aid may be more than $5 million. Both the small city aid base and the job city aid base will both increase based on inflation the same way that city need does under the current formula. Section 5, as I said, is the extra county transition aid. This is additional, it's reinstating the transition aid that was paid to some very poor counties in 2007. It also provides an additional court county program aid of $100,000 to Pine County to help pay for its court-ordered courthouse. That's from last year's veto tax bill, and provides an additional county program aid of $250,000 annually for the next 3 years to Beltrami County. I believe this was Representative Saylor's bill dealing with some extreme out-of-home placement costs related to the flood in the county. Town aid is a new program. We haven't had town aid several years. I want to say 2001 was the last time we had township aid. The amount of aid a township will receive is $100 plus about $2.85 per capita. For unorganized townships, those payments will be made to the county. Section 7 is the actual formula aid. This aid now includes city job space and small city aid, as well as the difference between the need and its ability to pay. And for aids payable in 2009 only, the data used in calculating this formula aid is the 2008 data. And this is straight from the Unity Bill. Section 8 is the actual city distribution. City distribution is your total city aid plus your city formula aid. It eliminates the provision that said half of your aid is based on last year's formula and half is based on this year's formula. That was replaced with the average need in Section 1. It increases the maximum increase in a city's aid from 10% of its levy in the previous year to 40% of its levy in the previous year for 2009 only, to allow the money from the extra $50 million to go to the cities who are actually on the formula. And it adjusts the maximum aid loss for small cities only to basically allow the elimination of small city aid for very wealthy small cities that, you know, their tax base really offsets their needs from the small city aid base. The one thing I forgot to mention, which is a significant difference from the Unity Bill in Section 7, is that this formula continues to work in the future. Under the Unity Bill, under Section 7 and 8, the money that was determined in 2009 became the money that you got in the future, just increased by the percentage increase in the appropriation. So in this case, the formula will continue to distribute the money. Section 9 is the appropriations. As I said, the appropriation for LGA is increased by $50 million. There is a, we also picked up an appropriation fix that had been in the department policy bill here and moved it into here. There are some offsets to city LGA appropriation, and the department recommended repealing those because it wasn't like the money actually went to the agencies that we were taking it off for, like for the demographer's costs or the state auditor's costs. It was a reduction from the LGA appropriation, but the money wasn't then transferred to those agencies. So what we did is we repealed the deduction and we just lowered the total appropriation by that amount. So the money that's being distributed is still the same money that's been being distributed. That's increased. It's just we've gotten rid of the repeal of money. Section 10 is the city foreclosure grant. There's $1 million for this. It goes to cities where either the city or a zip code in the city has a foreclosure rate that is higher, that is 50% higher than the average foreclosure rate in the 7-county metro area. The Commissioner of Revenue was going to work with the Commissioner of the Housing Finance Agency to determine what are the areas that that could apply. Cities apply, and then the amount is distributed based on the number of foreclosed homes in each of the qualifying areas divided by the $1 million, and no city can receive more than $250,000 under that. And as I said, Section 11 is a study of aid for local governments, and it does require that not only does the group, which is made up of legislators and local governments, study the aid programs and make recommendations, it also requires them to look at the relationship between aid and local sales taxes. And finally, Section 12 is the repealer that had been in the department's policy bill related to the various costs for demographers, state auditors, etc. And that has been taken care of in Section 10.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Questions on Article 2? If not, we'll go to Article 3. So we can jump back to Article 2 if someone thinks of something. Mr. Michael, Article 3.
Article 3 contains the income and one estate tax provision. Sections 1 and 3 are the result of the Chair's Bill. If you recall, this is the bill that related to officers' liability and time for filing claims that former Commissioner James testified that Chair directed the two commissioners to figure something out, and this is the result of that. I don't think that former Commissioner James is satisfied, but basically what it does in two instances, it gives a second right to a refund if a payment is made after all of the times for filing for a refund have expired. There's another 120-day period that they can apply for a refund. Sections 2 and 3 are also from that, from the Chair's bill on that, that provide that when the federal government grants an extension for corporate partnership and S-corp returns, Minnesota will automatically grant a similar extension, but this will not affect the time for paying the tax. Sections 5 and 6 are also from a different, from House File 4103, the Chair's bill on development subsidies, and this requires a portion of development subsidies to be added back. This is reduced from what was in the Chair's bill originally. First of all, there are categories of HIP districts that are excluded from this, and those are housing districts, soils districts, which are really pollution cleanup districts, and hazardous substance sub-districts. Secondly, the add-back is now calculated under the greater of two numbers. One is if the property owner has a pay-as-you-go development agreement that provides for tax increments to be paid directly to the developer, that amount will be added back. On the other hand, if the tax increment agreement simply has the city paying, using the tax increments to build things like public infrastructure, and there is a development agreement, then only one half of the increments will be added back. Section 7 is from the chair's bill that provides that the non-itemized or charitable deduction will be allowed against the alternative minimum tax. Section 8 is also the chair's bill that provides that the state for withholding tax purposes starting for in 2009 will no longer allow the Section 530 safe harbor from the 1978 Revenue Act. Section 9 is sort of a new technical provision that fixes an estate tax computation to be consistent with the way the law was computed in the past, so that it's clear how we're computing the federal tax limitation. This is just a sort of a technical correction that the department brought to our attention within the last couple of few weeks. Section 10, the last section of the article, repeals the special 100% sales apportionment formula for mail order sales companies. These companies would then go on the regular phase-in for single sales apportionment.
Thank you. Questions on Article 3?
Article 4 is the local development article. Section 1 and Section 5, our representative landings bill to allow a border cities credit similar to the North Dakota seed capital credit. The money for this would come out of the border cities appropriation to those five border cities along the South and North Dakota borders. All of the provisions from Representative Marquardt's bill on JobZ except the extension of the time for JobZ businesses are included in this. So this includes the provisions that give expanded access to the Office of the State Auditor in order to conduct JobZ audits, and it includes the changes in the clawback provisions that expand those provisions so that they apply to some businesses that get JobZ benefits but don't have business subsidy agreements, and clarifies how breaches of business subsidy agreements result in essentially remedies even though the business has not stopped operating in the zone. I'm not going to go through all of those provisions. There was a long hearing that the committee had on those provisions. Section 6 is Representative Gardner's, I believe it's Representative Gardner's provision on the Anoka County Library bonding that eliminates the $1.25 million limit and just relies on the market value percentage limit. Section 7 is the chair's bill increasing the HRA levy that's slightly reduced from her bill so that it increases the 0.0144 limit to 0.02. Section 8 is the correction of auditor errors in the tax increment that was the Dabney amendment. And then flipping ahead to the Section 15 is Representative Hornstein's authority for the Met Council to issue additional transit bonds. Section 16 includes a bill of Representative Mullery's and Representative Carlson's that expands each of those cities, Minneapolis and Crystal's, authority to use their housing replacement district increments. That's done in slightly different ways for the two different cities. Section 17 is the Hopkins HIF bill that Representative Simon carried. Section 18 is the Minneapolis Homeless HIF District, which is Representative Dabney's bill. Section 19 is the Fridley HIF provision that Representative Lane carried. Now, this is a reduced version of this per the HIF working group. It does not include any of the expanded authority to create multiple districts or to pool increments in the project area. All it does is expand the authority of the city to spend increments from this district that was authorized in Chapter 154 for more purposes related to the North Star Transit Station that's proposed in that city. Section 20 is also, that's Representative Knuth's New Brighton HIF bill, and this is also a slightly reduced version of her bill. It simply allows a four-year extension of those districts that are in the Northwest Quadrant. It does not allow pooling in increments from other districts in the city, as was in Representative Knuth's bill as introduced. Section 21 is Representative Poppy's bill for the City of Austin. Section 22 is the Chair's bill for the Bloomington Central Station five-year rule. Section 23 and 24, Representative Yaros' bill for Duluth to extend the five-year rule for two of those districts. Section 25 is Representative Cornish's bill that allows the City of Wells to essentially move some increments from the rent and selling of a building that was acquired with tax increment into the city's general fund. Section 26 is Representative Leader's multi-county HRA levy authority. This is modified from Representative Leader's bill to require a supermajority approval of those levies. Section 27 is a revised version of Representative Slawick's Oakdale TIF bill. Rather than granting a 10-year extension for a 35-year district, this allows the city to elect to write the value of the original tax capacity of that district down to the land value. Section 28 is a $1 million appropriation, half of which will go to the City of Minneapolis for Target Center improvements and half of which will go to the City of St. Paul for River Center improvements, and that's Article 4.
Questions on Article 4? If not, Article 5, I don't know if that's Ms. Baker, Mr. Hines, both?
Yep.
I know. You're going to go fast. Ms. Baker.
Okay. For the record, my name is Karen Baker, House Research.
And Steve Hines from House Research.
We thought it probably, given the time, it would be easier on page 17, where it's the overview. We have included a lot of all of the high points in the overview, so we thought we would go through that, and then, as time permits, if there's any questions, we can go back to others. The first thing is reducing the class rate on the first tier of ag homestead property from the 0.55 to the 0.5. Which was in Marquardt, reducing class rate on rental duplexes and triplexes to the same class rate structure that applies to homestead and single unit rental properties. That was Representative Loeffler's. Increasing class rate on electric generation personal property from 2% to 2.4 for taxes paid in 2009 and 2.8 for taxes payable in 2010 and thereafter. That was part of Representative Wolfslager's. The only thing is the provision in the bill does not increase the personal property for pipelines, water, gas. It leaves that at the same rate that it currently is at the 2%. It extends limited market value program for an additional 2 years. This was a Lanning PAMR amendment that was made in division. So in effect, instead of LMV phasing out, or I should say being gone really, by taxes payable in 2010, it will totally be gone in pay 2012. So it'll be at that 15% or 33% of the difference for two more years, and then the 50%, 15% or 50%, whichever is greater, and then it'll be gone by say 2012. One other provision that isn't on the list but that I'd like to mention is kind of the Bunn and Representative Bunn's bill, and Broad had discussed that, an amendment to it, and that, or a discussion point to it, and that was the vacant land that's platted, and the fact that in the metro area there was only a three-year platting provision in current statute, where in non-metro it's 7 years. The language that's in the bill here, which is sections 8 and 9 of the bill, they provide that beginning in August 1, 2008, metro and non-metro will be the same at the 7 years, but then it also provides that there's kind of a readjusted formula for property that was platted prior to August 1, 08 for in the metro.
Then the next bullet point refers to a number of changes that were made in the agricultural classification and the Green Acres eligibility laws, and this was the Conan-Demmer bill, for, I think exclusively or certainly mostly, that establishes a new classification, rural vacant land. It kind of breaks off a part of agricultural to rural vacant land class, with a stipulation then that rural vacant land would no longer be treated like agricultural property for class for tax rate purposes, but it would not be eligible for Green Acres program anymore, to try to tease apart those two commingled parts of the property tax base, the rural land and agricultural land. However, it does grandfather in all existing properties into the Green Acres program, so it would kind of have this reform moving forward. Also make some changes in the minimum acreage requirements, and it encompasses many of the sections in the Article 10, 12 to 18, 23, 26 are all related to this series of reforms in Ag and Green Acres. The next bullet refers to a package of proposals that are Representative Marquardt's that generally make improvements in the assessment process, improvements in quality and information. Section 5 it provides a recourse for citizens who feel like the assessments are not good in their jurisdiction to get a petition to have the Department of Revenue look into the situation within a given taxing jurisdiction about poor performance. Section 6 is just a requirement that assessors take into account foreclosures in the area of properties that are and determining the value of the value. Section 20 creates some new provides that the valuation statement should include information about where the taxpayer can find information the assessor has about their property, whether it be in an office or on a website or just where to alert them to where they can get the information that they're using to make the assessment. And Section 29 makes a number of reforms in how the county board works in terms of primarily of sort of requiring them to be open at more citizen-friendly times, like Saturdays, and keep some meetings going till at least 7 in the evening. I was going to mention one other previous that there's not a bullet for. There was a bill of Representative Broad's that provided for a reduced or a stepped-up valuation for properties improved as a result of a disaster, and it was extended also include foreclosed properties to allow that if the value is increased as a reconstruction after either of those kinds of events, it would be stepped up. Section 11.
The next bullet relates to providing a moratorium on changes in assessment practices for institutions of pure public charities. And it requires the Commissioner of Revenue to conduct a study and then report the findings back to the House and Senate. This has to do with the Under the Rainbow versus Goodhue County case. And really it is looking into just the property taxation of these purely public charities. The next bullet is on establishing, this is Representative Olin's bill, on establishing a state-paid property tax credit for property that's in these bovine TV management zones. It gives a state-paid credit on the land only, and there are two different provisions in there, one dealing with cattle herds and one dealing with deer and elk, and the one on deer and elk makes extra requirements of the people in order to get that, to make sure that they have satisfactorily done certain things before they can receive that credit.
The next two bullets establish the seasonal recreational property tax deferral program. This is exactly the same as in the 2007 bill. And also expanding eligibility for the senior deferral program. This is also exactly the same with a slight change that the income eligibility was increased from $75,000 to $80,000, but otherwise identical to last year's bill.
The next point is advancing the time frame for truth and taxation process. This does not start until taxes payable in 2010. And on page 36 and 37, there is a table which pretty much goes through all the advancements of the dates for the TMT process.
Sections 30 and 31 eliminate the exemption from the state general tax for property located at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and Holman Field. Section 27 provides a property tax credit. This is a variation of the bill brought forth by Representative Dill. Provides a property tax credit for seasonal recreational properties on lease land and land leased from a governmental unit. Section 62 provides for a study of the fiscal disparities program, also a provision from last year's bill. I wanted to mention another one that's not in the bullets. Representative Medora's bill to extend the Metro Transit District to cover the entire metro area. It doesn't change the levy amount, but just how it would be spread. It's spread throughout the metro area, whereas right now it's spread within the transit taxing districts, the more densely populated part of the metro area. Section 67 is a bill that came to us late from Representative Dabney that it has to do with the federal audit of some social service programs in the school systems, and the feds were saying that some of the money that they've granted has to be paid back. The bill provides that the state will pay one-third of it back to the school districts, one-third of their share in fiscal 9, and then provides a levy authority for the other two-thirds in fiscal 10 and 11. And then Section 68 is the bill brought forth by Representative Yaros on the Duluth School District lease purchase programs, and requires them to go through more of a public hearing process and allows for a reverse referendum on those.
And the last one I'd like to mention that should have gotten on the list was the Chair's Section 58 on converting the percentage limit on the economic development abatements from that 10% of tax levy to 10% of the net tax capacity, and it's in Section 58.
Thank you for that.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Thank you very much. Article 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see we have 6 minutes, and I'm hoping to do this in four.
Oh.
Article 6.
Don't waste time giggling.
It's the sales and use tax. Sections 1, 3, 4, and 5 are the Tilbury bill related to sales tax exemption for light rail transit and the North Star Corridor. The difference from the bill is that a upfront appropriation is made to the Commissioner of Revenue in which to pay the refunds and exemptions related to these. That number is blank right now in the bill, but it will be changed to $15 million in the author's amendment. Section 2 is the expansion of the Regional Public Safety Radio Communications System exemption to include Itasca County, and this was Representative Solberg's bill from last year. Section 6 is Representative Marcos' bill, basically prohibiting local governments from advertising, promoting, spending money, holding an election to support a local sales tax. It doesn't apply to any sales tax that's authorized by special law prior to the end of this session, and the prohibition runs until December 31st, 2011. Section 7 has two motor vehicle sales tax exemptions. One is Representative Cole's for the purchase of vehicles while by a member of the military while serving on active duty outside of the country. And the second one was in last year's Visa tax bill and allows a charitable organization that holds a motor vehicle dealer's license to do a transfer to a client who's on a lease-to-own program without paying the sales tax. Mm-hmm. And this basically is a provision for the Greater Twin Cities United Way. Sections 8 through 11 is Representative Reinhart's Mankato local sales tax bill. The main difference is that they are granted the authority for the admissions tax and the food and beverage tax, which will now go to pay their operating costs. Their operating costs are eliminated as a use for their regular local sales tax. They are allowed to spend the regular local sales tax for the Performing Arts Theater and Women's Hockey Center. However, the expiration date is not changed from what it is in current law. Section 12 is Representative Bill's bill for the Cook County Lodging and Admissions Tax. The only difference from the bill as introduced is that a termination date has been added to it. It will terminate 15 years. Those taxes will terminate 15 years after first imposed. Sections 13, 14, and 15 are the local sales tax provisions for the cities of Clearwater, North Mankato, and cities of Winona. These were local sales tax provisions that were in last year's veto tax bill and were originally going to be in this year's first bill and were not included, and they are included here in exactly the same form. And that's it.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Questions? Members, put your stuff back in your folders. I want to say for the record, it is not yet midnight. We will have plenty of time tomorrow for all the questions and all the pieces. We'll begin at 9 with public testimony. Thank you. We're adjourned.